Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com on this February the 6th on the West Coast, or if you're on the Eastern or Central time zones, it's February the 7th, 2009. So nice to have you with us this evening. And before we bring tonight's regular Friday night guest on board, I've got quite a bit of interesting information to give you, not necessarily an amount of time that it takes to deliver it, but just in terms of numbers. We talk about numbers a lot on the show. We've been talking about the numbers that are used by people that practice alchemic magic, or the magi out there that like to honor what numbers mean in their little codes and their little rituals, and sometimes even their dirty deeds. Numbers are in the math of the universe. The Creator gave us a very sacred kind of math, and it's found in many places. It's found in science. It's found in music. In fact, I love the fact that it's in music, because that's what my background has been. And it's found in encoded in our alphabets, in our languages. For instance, if a cursory study of the three-letter names or acronyms given to television networks or radio networks, radio stations in particular parts of the country, for instance, in the United States, always can be attributed to some numerical meaning. One wonders how or why they come up with these things, but it represents some secret magic ritual. The mainstream networks on what used to be antenna analog TV, ABC, CBS, NBC, are all related to the use of these numbers. If you do a simple mathematical calculation, numbering numbers 1 through 9, the letters of the alphabet, when you run out of numbers, go back to 1. So you would go A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, and continue on with that sequence of numbers 1 through 9. You will find that there is a pattern of 1 through 9, and it'll take you all the way through the alphabet, and you can then look at ABC and see that the numbers add up to 1, 2, 3, or the number 6. You take CBS and do the same thing with that, and breaking down numbers, leaving out zeros when you get to double digits, you will get a 6 from CBS. NBC works out differently. But if you look at the NBC tone that they used to chime on a sort of an orchestral chime, they were actually playing the notes, G-E-C, and when you add up the letters for G-E-C, you get a 6. And the three major networks for years, under our noses, were 666, the number of the mystical Antichrist. And when you look at Fox, F-O-X, today, it's a big news network now, and especially on cable and satellite TV, the numbers all work out to 666 right in the name Fox. And with some exceptions, for instance, CNN is 13. That's the Illuminati families represented in CNN, right under our noses. So they get into numbers. We have numbers listening to our show. We have 22 international intelligence agencies that I'd like to welcome to Evident Footprints. Hopefully you learn something on this show. Not only what we know, but maybe what you thought you knew and thought that you were the only ones that knew. In other words, information is all over the universe, folks, and it's meant to be shared. It's not designed to go to a select few, elite. It's there available for everyone. and the problem that you are having and your insecurities and your own fears and your own controlling nature is that you are the ones that are controlled, and you're having great difficulty dealing with that reality. And so you feel that a show like this and the guests that come on the show and even the host of the show or the network that the show is on may be a threat to you because you have a secret plan that's been discovered and been exposed to the light. And it's been done not by me, not by my guests, not by the network, or not by the listening audience, but by God himself, the creator of the universe, the creator of all things. And the entity that you follow that you like to call Satan or secretly call Lucifer, the angel of light, was cast down from heaven a long, long time ago, and ever since he's been trying to be God, and he's coerced you into following him under the pretense that he will make you a god someday, and many of you are trying to act like you are God, not right now. And so there's a battle going on, but the battle is within your own psyches, because while you are attempting to control the whole world, we're going to create a new one. And we have God on our side doing that. It's God's plan. It's not our plan. We're just going along with it. And we have a choice, and we're taking the high road while you march along the low road to your own destruction. So we offer you the opportunity to consider there's a better place for you to go, much better than the one you think you have found, and you are going to dominate the rest of the planet with. It's not going to occur that way. Now, there were other numbers beyond these 22 international intelligence agencies that monitor this show and shows like this. And that's great numbers of people. It's come to my attention that we're not actually getting the true numbers. Well, I don't get the true numbers on my website. And I'm sure Jeff Renz or Ken Adachi or any of the other great websites out there, and I don't even put mine on a caliber with those, as far as sharing information, they're probably getting much higher numbers than what is reported. And whatever means you use to fudge the numbers, it's like the numbers you fudge when you hold a national election or when you do your Tavistock polling exercises, that 80% of the people or 87% of the people are for this candidate or that candidate, and you've never even taken a poll. Well, we happen to know that there are over 20 million people that have been listening to the show on a nightly basis for some time. In fact, one night, a couple of weeks ago, on a Thursday night, we had over 30 million listeners. And so who does that credit go to? It doesn't go to this show, doesn't go to my guests. Maybe the popularity of the show, or maybe the popularity of the guests, maybe even a little bit to the host, but that credit goes to the listeners and ultimately to God, who led those people to this show and shows like this. And so tonight our hat is off to the listening audience, which I've learned very recently is all around the world, in all the countries that you're trying to control and overtake with your demonic and satanic and Luciferian activities, your deception, your deceit, your murder, and all the dark things that you do, people come to the light, and they're coming by the millions. And I thank God for that, and I thank the listening audience. Tonight, this show is for you. With that, I bring on board Evident Footprints. Once again, my good friend, scientist, inventor, author, teacher and lecturer, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Don. As usual, it's a real pleasure to be here with you and to share an evening not only with your company, but also with the apparent multitudes that you are now aware of. Very nice to know we have that many ears out there listening.
Yeah, it's quite a surprise. You know, I always knew, I could sense in my spirit that there were a lot of people listening to the show. And I've had my knocks on politics and on government. And then as long as they act like they're acting, I'm going to keep knocking. them, okay? There is a lot of good that can come out of any show like this, and you know, as well as the listening audience knows, that we bring our highest intention to this show every night, every week, at least five nights a week, and I trust that you're going to do that. It is a nice surprise, though, isn't it, to know that there are that many people listening?
Well, I'm glad that there are that many, and I hope that there'll be eventually many more, because, you know, our intention has always been to bring the truth to people, and I pray to God that the people that are listening understand the gravity of the present situation and are thirsty for the truth and willing to help us spread the information that we disclose, and let's say we will broaden the ranks as quickly as possible.
Yes. Now, you know, there's one more math equation that we could investigate for a moment here, and that's the old saying that they use in sales and in motivational series, discussions about how to get people involved in things. Everybody knows at least 10 people. The average individual anywhere on the earth has 10 acquaintances, 10 friends, maybe even a total of 10 friends and enemies. And if they went to those 10 people and they told them about something that they felt excited about, something that was good, something that was possibly educational or enlightening or different from everything else, and they told those 10 people about that particular thing, whatever it is. It could be a radio show, for example. Imagine that those 20 or 30 million people that might be out there listening right now were to go to 10 people and say, you've got to tune into this radio show. You've got to listen to what's being said. Then imagine overnight we could have 200 or 300 million listeners. And imagine that if those two or 300 million listeners were to talk to their 10 friends and do the same thing one more time, you would almost have half the planet listening to this show. Now, no one in their right mind would wish that upon themselves, and that the likelihood of that happening is very slim, but that easily it could happen. And if it happened one more time beyond that, the whole planet would be listening. Everybody would be paying attention, and everybody would be hearing a consistent message, and so our attention would be brought into a place where we would arrive at awareness, and we would gain some insight and some wisdom, and we would all start being what they promise us but never deliver. This thing about world peace, you know, war is not the path to peace. War is the path to death and destruction, period. There's no other reason for creating war other than the one they use it for, and that's to act out a script that puts money in their pockets and gives them a sense of power. All the power that they have, I feel no less powerful, I have to tell you, because I don't value those things anymore in my life. The things that I was brought up to value and to strive for mean absolutely nothing, because I've come to understand that they're all illusions. You know, even this radio show might be an illusion in a sense, but in another sense, it's serving a purpose. And so as I grow, as my listening audience grows, and I say I grow in my consciousness, my awareness, my insight, hopefully we have that impact that we can offer that opportunity to others. They can make that choice for themselves. And we don't ask anyone to believe in us, but just think about how the numbers multiply. And that's going to kind of be a segue into tonight's topic, which is the continuation of our exploration into the El Dorado gold, the seven cities of gold that you brought up. And where did we leave off with that, Jim? Can you refresh our memories?
Yeah, sure, I can, Don. But, you know, if you'll permit me, there's one thing I wanted to contribute in the same vein that you had just been speaking.
Oh, I apologize.
That's okay. And that is that, these illusions, we become so accustomed to illusions on a regular basis that we don't even realize that they're there until somebody points them out to us. And two of them, which are so incredible, I just have to make mention of. One of them is in line with what you were saying, and that is, not only can you not use war to establish peace, but you can't borrow your way to prosperity either. And, that's basically what these idiots are proposing. They're going to borrow their way, into a nation of prosperity. Well, that certainly will never happen. And the other thing which is interesting, and I see this all over the television now, and it's so amazing to me that I'm shocked by it, and that is that people are being coerced to surrender their gold in return for paper. Now, if I had a pallet full of gold ingots, do you think I'd be eager to trade them to you, Don, for a pallet of used newspapers? It's the same type of a transaction. You get the people are so hoodwinked because they don't understand the monetary system that they're willing to give up gold, which has real intrinsic value, for a piece of paper that's got some peculiar vegetation and old men and a lot of scribbling and what have you on it, but has no intrinsic value of its own. And that, to me, is a very big illusion.
Well, yes, that's one that we've covered on the show many times with you and with many of the other guests. And it's not something that's peculiar to the United States. This is all over the world. Every country in the world is going through the same thing because you have the same group of characters running the same system. So it's not surprising. Now, in light of that and the topic that we discussed last week has everything to do with that reality, because that is so true what you said, that the paper is literally worth nothing. It's merely a representation of debt, isn't it?
Yes, that's all right on it.
Yes.
It's a note. How can you pay a bill with a note? Just try going to your grocer's and buying a couple $100 worth of food and then say, listen, I'll give you an IOU for it. It doesn't work out. Well, actually, a note is worse than an IOU because a note is a certificate that represents somebody else's promise to pay.
Yes, and it has interest attached to it.
Oh, gobs of interest. But anyway, yes, you're right. The whole premise of what we were trying to lead up to with this concept here of the centuries-long pursuit for El Dorado actually ties into this entire situation. And the reason that we're presenting it in the way that we were is because it's got a real historical and a real adventurous side to things. And, of course, there are numerous scientific spin-offs as well as certain benefits for society that have come out of all of this. But the interesting thing is where it winds up. And you had asked me, where did we leave off? Well, actually, we had several interesting tangents that spun off of last week's show, but I really believe that what we were up to, we had discussed the various explorers, both in old times and in recent times, who had actually been looking for El Dorado, and we had discussed the hardships that they went through in the wilderness of South America looking for this place. And so actually what we were up to, I believe, Don, was what is the estimated worth of this incredible treasure that they were looking for. That's where I believe we left mm-hmm. off.
Yeah, we discussed the possibility that place, the location of that mine, might possibly be Peru, I think, right?
Actually, that brings up another interesting point. But before I address that, let me just touch on this because to give an idea, the estimated worth that has already come out of Peru during the time of the Spanish occupation and which was transported back to Spain, to the church, to the Vatican, and to other places, is literally in the hundreds of trillions of dollars. I mean, and that's what's already transpired. Now, that doesn't even cover what may be left in the ground or may be left in the area that that we're talking about. And
yeah.
What we were addressing, I think, when the show closed last week is, despite all of the hardships involved in going to these incredibly out-of-the-way places, you know, what could possibly motivate people to go there? Well, of course, on the top of the list is greed and avarice, which has always been a very big motivating factor in human activities. But there's also the sense of adventure, the desire for real knowledge, and, of course, there's a certain amount of fame that goes along with all of this, providing you survive. But we're talking about areas which are, even today, so remote and so just over-endowed with hardships that it's really a wonder that anybody was in and out of these places.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have mosquitoes, bugs of all kinds. I mean, and by the billions, not like the experiences we have here in the States. You've got all kinds of venomous serpents. You've got blood-sucking bats. You've got piranhas. You've got headhunters, which still exist. You've got jaguars and all kinds of other animals that have no provocation whatsoever of attacking human beings. And lack of food, lack of clean water, excessive temperatures and humidities, and on top of all of that, you don't know where you're going. So it's not an ideal walk in the park to go to these places. And everything there is trying to kill you. So you have to be a special breed of person to undertake an exploration of this sort. And I would say that things haven't changed that much in the last 300 years because the jungles and the wilderness in South America literally is in a time lock. It doesn't even realize what century it is. Nothing has changed to speak of, for tens of thousands of years.
So there's the possibility that there's no global warming there, you're saying, right?
Whatever kind of warming they got there, they've had for a long, long time.
Yeah. Well, it's and there's a mystical sort of protection. I get this impression that all of this danger and this inconvenience that surrounds the place, it's almost like God's way of making it a forbidden land, if you get my meaning.
Yeah, and it could well be that that's the case, although it could also be a coincidence. It's not for us to know. But the interesting thing about what you just brought up, when Colonel Fawcett was exploring in that neck of the woods, there was a very persistent rumor, if you want to call it that, that was going around, that a very ancient civilization, we don't know who they were or where they came from, which was situated somewhere in the heart of the South American hinterlands, literally encouraged their position to be surrounded by the most primitive, the most backward, and the most ferocious natives and headhunters available, simply because they wanted to remain in obscurity. And this actually is a very interesting story, because it explains why there's a dichotomy of understandings that goes hand in hand with this whole legend of El Dorado. On the one hand, you have the Spaniards running around all over the place looking for this place because it is supposed to be a very wealthy city, several cities. They could never get their story straight. I mean, there was always a different slant to it whenever you heard it. Some of them just felt that this needed to be conquered so that they would have absolute control of the area. The others didn't care about any of the politics. They were there for the gold. The interesting thing is that there was actually a third antagonistic party involved, which is often not given much credit, and that's the Indians in the area themselves. They hated the Spanish. They were always being used for slaves. They were considered subhuman. They were tortured and killed by the hundreds of thousands. And so they realized that the Spaniards were after gold and wealth and didn't have any spiritual inclinations. So they sent them off on incredible wild goose chases just to get them out of their hair. So, and they died in their thousands marching around in these incredible jungles and swamps looking for this stuff. But if you listen to what the Indians had to say, rather than what the Spanish historians have to say, and this is what Colonel Fawcett was an expert at doing. He made friends with the various native tribes, brought them gifts, learned their languages, which takes a lot of doing, and actually frequented with them and learned their habits and their social ways, and then started trading stories with them, and that's how he learned about various things that were going on. Mm-hmm. Well, according to the Indians, the story is entirely different. According to the Indians, there is a source of gold, which is one situation, and then there is an area to which the gold is brought. And that area, from Indian tradition or native tradition, was referred to as the Empire of Musus, M-U-S-U-S. And there was supposedly an emperor in this region of Musus, which had dominance over all of the original native tribes in the entire continent of South America. And this would go back, of course, before the arrival of foreigners from Europe. But the interesting thing is that the Incas made regular pilgrimages down from the mountains, from the Andes Mountains, heading east into the jungles, with literally hundreds of llamas loaded down with gold, and would take that gold to this secret destination called the Kingdom of Musus. And so apparently the source of the gold was in a different direction than the place where the gold was delivered. And this caused great confusion, because according to the Spaniards then, everything became known as El Dorado. And they were all split up in their focus. You know, some were going north, some were going south, some were going east, some were going west, and most of them were dying. And the interesting thing about it is that the entire effort that was expended in trying to locate this hidden kingdom, wherever it may have been, it was never found. And But the mines that supplied the wealth for this tribute that was paid to Musus, they were found on a number of locations, And principally, there were seven of them. And that's the reason why you have the legend of the seven cities of El Dorado. Let me see if I can pronounce the names of these places. Okay. The so-called seven cities were, the first one was known as Santiago de la Montanos. And another one was San Francisco de Boya. Then there was Legrumo, San Reyes, Jean de Barracamaros. This next one, I don't know if I can get out or not. Baja de Loros. And the last one is Zamora. So those seven locations were interpreted to be seven actual cities. But the most recent information that we have concerning not only their locations, but what was found at these sites, they actually came from the efforts of a guy by the name of Leonard Clark. And Leonard Clark made an expedition on his own with one native accompanying him in June of 1946. And it took him a year to move from Lima, Peru, through the wilderness until he found several of these locations. And the most striking thing about what he had to say was that there were no ancient cities at these spots. What was there were mines which had been worked from great antiquity, and that was something which, according to him, was very evident. There were Spanish settlements there, which were very crude, adobe-type structures that were used to house whoever was working the mines under their auspices. And then there were, of course, the normal sluice gates and water troughs and things of that sort, which may have been there for a very long time. But there were no real cities. And he made it out of there with a small fortune in gold dust, which he smuggled out inside bamboo canisters that he made, you know, just by cutting bamboo from the jungle and filling it with gold dust. But he risked his life going in there and his life coming out of there. Now, the most interesting thing that he had to say concerning this entire situation was that he had gotten the map to go to this location by investigating, of all things, church documents. And it turns out that the Jesuits were in charge of these mines quite a few years ago. When I say quite a few years ago, I mean several hundred years ago. Mm. And they may very well still remain involved with some of this stuff because we don't know whether these mines are still active or not. But the thing that's interesting is all the wealth that has been brought out of there is probably, a lot of it has been retained in Peru. And this brings us up to the interesting relationship between a modern conception, which relates to this story, called the Russell Trust, and how that trust ties in with the entire world banking situation. And Don, that's something I know you know a great deal about, so I'd like for you to pick up the ball at this point and tell us what you know on this subject.
Well, I've heard, and of course, these are bits and pieces of information that have surfaced from various writers. There could be quite a bit of disinformation put out there to quell the numbers. When you in relationship to what you're talking about, imagine that there's someone has the ownership in a sense of a gold mine, probably the world's largest natural repository of gold. And they're willing to give the paper money that you've talked about, or the instruments that the fiat banking system uses to lend to the governments of the world, or to give to people through government programs, some of it to be paid back, some of it just given with no requirement to return the money, and they call these grants or they have a variety of names for them, but you hear these advertised on television. Even, you know, somebody will publish a book or, you know, teach you a way to secure a piece of these funds that are intended to promote business or create wealth. And so this gold mine is used as the actual collateral. Now, this is done in a strange way when you consider that the paper itself has no value. There's an intrinsic value to the activity or the entity that is created through the grant. Let's say it's a grant to buy real estate. Then ultimately the person that holds the deed to the paper, the illusory wealth, through the assets represented by the gold, would then have a right, or at least this is how the game is practiced, to foreclose on the property or to seize the property and take possession of the property, regardless of the means, whatever label you want to put on it. So it's difficult for people to understand exactly how that works, because we're talking about an illusion when we come to, as you pointed out, and we've pointed this out in, with our an example in relation to our own Federal Reserve and our U.S. Treasury. The Treasury borrows money, or the collateralized value, which comes from that gold mine, from the Federal Reserve, which is a cabal of international bankers that really have no right to do that under our Constitution. Now, under our Admiralty law, or under the administrative procedure of constitutional law, and that's different from the Republic, the Republican form of law. In other words, we had a constitution that made us a sovereign entity, and yet over time we have become an administrative body, a corporation, if you will, a secret corporation that operates one agenda different from the one that's presented to the public. So this money, this gold, is the actual collateral that is borrowed against. And they create paper out of thin air, which is why they can do that, because they're using those assets. And it depends upon who owns the assets as to who's going to get control of the entity that's created from the paper money, from the illusory money. So this is the premise under which a government or any government can give free money away that doesn't have to be paid back, because ultimately they can seize the property, seize the business, seize the land, seize the assets, which are nothing more than more of the same illusion, more of the same promissory aspect of the original intention. Say, for instance, you want to start a business and you go to the government, and the government says, okay, we have $3 billion available and you're entitled to get $10 million of that. And you don't have to pay it back as long as you open this kind of business, hire so many people, and all these people are paying taxes, so they're paying back, or they're returning back their ownership of what that gold mine wealth represents. But they have an illusory piece of paper. They have a debt instrument, actually, because it has interest attached to it. Not only is it worth what it's represented by in the gold assets, but it's worth more on top of that to the holder of the paper, or the issuer of the paper. Well, it's the Federal Reserve, the foreign entity that was snuck in during the Christmas season of 1913, while Congress was about to go out of session. They created a phony emergency and said that, yeah, we have to have this central bank for our nation to survive. though we'd already survived well over 100 years by that time, for some reason it was against the words and the writings of our founding fathers, insane to do such a thing, that it was corrupt and that it would lead to the destruction of this country, which is exactly what's happening today. So that Russell Trust has been used to finance all kinds of operations, maybe some building of certain aspects of our infrastructure in this country, and yet that has been given over to foreign entities because of these foreign interests holding the debt instruments, the paper money itself. So it's a very shrewd game that's being played. They don't necessarily have possession of that gold in the mine, and yet they've been given permission to create an economy, to generate wealth directed ultimately into the hands of the very people who probably have some or all the control of that mine. And so, in a sense, we're talking about something that has value that's being put up as collateral to create a whole bunch of fictitious wealth or monetary value. And it's called economics. It's called the gross domestic product, and it's called the stock market, and it's called the central banks, and it's called the U.S. Treasury and the Federal Reserve and the IRS. It's all interwoven, and it's all smoke and mirrors. The real wealth is in that gold mine, but not in that the gold is sitting in that mine, but that it would actually be brought out and dispersed amongst all the people on the planet. Why should it belong to a select group of people, you would have to ask yourself? Why should it belong, or why should it be the play toy of the very people that create the fiat money system and the usury system, which is the credit card system or the commercial loan system or any aspect that's a derivative of that? In fact, they found a way to do the same thing in the stock market. They made derivatives where they stole, or they're stealing public money, public assets, signed ultimately back to that gold or other similar gold deposits in other parts of the world. There's one like that in Indonesia. They're stolen gold from the world wars that ended up buried in the hills of the Philippines and other places. Money that was stolen from China, or money that was, and some of that was stolen by Japan, hidden in the Philippines. Marcos found that money. What happened to Marcos? They found the gold. Marcos found the gold. We found Marcos. Marcos got cancer or heart problems. They brought Imelda to New York and took her to court, and they seized all their assets. And they seized everything in Fort Knox. And they seized everything underneath the World Trade Center, and they went to Iraq and stole $100 trillion worth of riches from there, from their central bank. So it's a pattern of both stealing the gold as well as using that gold that's sitting there in that trust. Somehow that is protected. How much that is, I don't really know. But that's sort of a synopsis of really how gold is playing out today. And they're even now trying to take it from people again, as FDR did back in 1933, making it illegal to own gold, or you faced imprisonment or extreme fines, where people didn't have any money to begin with, so it would be transmuted into a prison sentence to create fear and to create poverty and to bring this country again to its knees. Virtually, this country is bankrupt since 1933. And it only took them 20 years to do that. So, I don't know if that answers your question, but that's kind of what that mine represents. It's not the only one, but it may be the largest.
No, it answers the question, but more importantly, it also opens the door to explaining what's really happening, you know, right now in the world economic scene.
Sure.
These banks, all over the world, not just in the United States, have been servicing criminal activities from all the various world governments for many, many years. And all of that wealth that has been usurped from the people and stolen by any number of mechanisms has been hidden away in these banks off balance sheet, which means that the wealth is in there. The banks love having it, but they keep a hidden set of books, which basically keeps track of that wealth. And those banks that participated in this type of activity, they know full well that they're harboring ill-gotten gains. There's no secret about that. Now, the interesting thing is the rest of the world community comes along and says, listen, we can't tolerate all of this nonsense anymore because we are depleting the planet of wealth. We're so criminal anymore that nobody knows which way is up. People are suffering unnecessarily, and it's actually starting to affect the economy. So they want to go ahead and introduce a completely transparent banking system known as Basel 1, 2, and 3. And so basically, according to the Basel banking system, the banking computers now are so powerful that they can keep track of transactions forward and backward some hundred generations. So that theoretically every dime can be tracked.
That's
and in order to put all of this into universal action so that most of the dishonesty in the world would be eliminated, the first thing that has to happen is the banks have to come forth with all this hidden wealth and literally put it on the books. Now, the problem with doing that is that in doing so, they're going to have to say, well, so-and-so put $1 trillion in here, and that's going to put so-and-so in a very hot seat. So the banks were quite shrewd. What they said instead was, well, look, we don't have any problem bringing all this wealth out of the woodwork. But we have to let the people who are responsible for stealing it and putting it in here, let them work it out as to how it's going to wind up. In other words, who's going to have ownership of it after the fact? And so until all of these criminals associated with most of the governments work that out, the banks just decided that they're going to go offline. And by doing so, they no longer offer credit to anybody. So a lot of the other countries have already agreed to settle this, but the United States government said, oh, no, we've been in control. We're going to keep right on using the fiat money. We're going to keep right on putting our ill-gotten gains to work the way we want to for world domination, new world order, and all this kind of stuff. And so as a result of that, all that wealth is now locked up. Even the banks in the United States have money in it that they're not bringing out simply because of this controversy. So to get themselves out of a tailspin, they passed this nonsensical ruling that basically says that they have to have a bailout because the system is falling apart. They didn't tell you the truth that the system is falling apart because of their criminal activities. So naturally, they go to the public and say, well, look, we're going to print money to shore up all these failing companies and to help these banks that refuse to issue further credit. And we're going to do that essentially at the cost of your children, your grandchildren, and your great-great-grandchildren, and if you don't like it, that's too bad. And that's the real crux of the issue. So, you know, it's a shame that people don't understand their own government and realize what's happening and realize how the financial situation is being controlled and manipulated at their expense. If people really understood this, we'd have one heck of a hanging party in Washington.
Yeah. Jim, I don't mean to interrupt you because you're hitting all the points that, you know, we've talked about on past shows and have been a major part of my research, my published articles. So we have Leo from Massachusetts on the line. Would you like to take a call from him?
Well, sure. We always take calls.
Okay. Leo, welcome to Evident Footprints. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking the call. You know, I've been wondering. I think that the discussion of alternative currencies and removing our labor from their system is the only proactive way to stop it. And it's a really tough road to hoe because you're swimming against the tide. And so that, I mean, is alternative currency the only way out of this?
No. You're going to change my, in my opinion, I'm going to let Jim answer this, but I'm saying to you, Leo, replacing one illusion with another is not the answer. I mean, think about it. If they come out with the Amero, that's a representation of their intention to create a North American Union.
That's not quite what
which
I
is
did.
An illegal act. That was attempted at least by the Bush administration. Now it's left to yet to be seen if the Obama administration, which is really illegal, because he's yet to prove his citizenship, and I can tell you he cannot. And anyone in the world listening to this knows that that's a fact. Even Obama supporters have to admit he hasn't shown he's an American. And so, you know, if Jesus came down here and said, well, he wants to rule the country, are you going to pick Obama over Jesus?
Anyway, when I meant alternative currency, I wasn't referring to the Amero. I was thinking of something like a barter type currency where we trade our labor and we screw the rest of the system.
Well, you're talking about an alternative economy, I think, because that's going to change everything. The currency is a representation of some wealth, right? An exchangeable item that can produce something else. Now, in that sense, yes, but you're talking about a totally different economy based upon that system.
I mean, but short of that, I think we're going to be stuck in the same game all over again. And, I mean, I don't see any way out of it because, so we dump the IRS, we'll still go to a fiat currency. And hopefully it's one that we'll have some kind of measure of control over, but...
You said dump the IRS, and then you said...
No, I meant the Fed.
The IRS has nothing to do with our currency.
No,
that's
I meant the Fed.
Leo, hang on a second. I'm making a clarification for the listening audience. The IRS is a foreign entity based in Puerto Rico, okay? The Federal Reserve is a foreign entity masking itself as the controlling entity over our U.S. Treasury. Constitutionally, in our republic... The Republic of the United States and its Constitution states that only the U.S. Treasury has the power to create and issue money, not the Federal Reserve. So we were swindled in 1913 when they let the Federal Reserve become that controlling entity. That's the point I'm trying to make. Go ahead.
Well, if you look at the timeline and what happened in 1913, you look at what happened in 1914. Isn't that interesting?
What happened in 1914, different from 1913?
World War One.
Well, okay, of course, but we had the Boer War before that,
the Boer War wasn't to the scale. It was a matter of scale, and so I think that, you know, if you're building a masterpiece and you need the last important piece in place, to me that was the Federal Reserve control over the United States economic structure that they needed to be in place before they started the First World War.
Okay, what year would you say the Boer War was? Do you know?
It was the English and the Dutch down in South Africa.
Yeah, basically the turn of the century. Actually, I think they were still fighting in 1903.
Are you familiar with the song by Ian Campbell? At the turning of the century, I was a boy of five. My father went to fight the Boers and never came back alive.
Okay.
You heard that one?
Yeah, I want to make a statement about that time period because 1903 was the first date I could track Paul Warburg sneaking into the United States claiming he was an American citizen. It's documented at Ellis Island. So while the Boer War was going on or winding up, there was already an infusion or an infiltration into the United States by these central bankers 10 years before the Federal Reserve was created. And they had actually tried to pull this off in the late 1800s as well, several times. It's not a one shot deal, and they struck pay dirt. This is over a period of time. Jim, do you want to make a comment?
No, I'm in absolute agreement with you. They've been actually trying to introduce centralized banking in this country for many, many years. As a matter of fact, Alexander Hamilton, the famous duel between Alexander Hamilton and, what was the other guy's name?
Aaron Burr.
Aaron Burr was actually over that same issue. So, I mean, this has been going on, you know, since the foundation of the country. But, you know, to answer your question, even with the phony setup that exists right now with the Federal Reserve authorizing the Treasury to print so many dollars, for distribution, into the economic system of the country, it could actually work without screwing the people, providing that they didn't attach interest to every dollar that's printed. If they spent the money into circulation, the economy would do just fine. The problem is they don't do that. They loan it into circulation, and they deliberately do not permit the printing of the money that would be necessary to pay the interest. So it's like a game of musical chairs. You never have enough chairs for the people that are playing the game. And it's the same thing with what they do. They essentially always make sure that the amount of money that's in circulation is never enough to pay the accumulating interest. And in doing so, they perpetuate debt indefinitely, and then by further diluting the money that's in circulation through inflationary means, which is nothing more than a mechanism for hidden tax, they slowly take people out of the game. This is the reason why there's all these foreclosures. This is the reason why companies are closing. And, the ultimate deal is that they will own everything, and the United States will be reduced to a collection of vagabonds worse off than a third world country.
Yeah. Now, Jim, if I can make a comment and answer Leo's question regarding a bartering system, because, Leo, I think you're onto something there. In fact, we have talked about that on the show. You may not have heard some past shows that we've done with various guests who've entertained this idea, one of them being Michael St. Clair. Now, if you were to imagine that we had no banks, or let's say they shut down the banks because they wanted to stop money from circulating to bring us to our knees, what would you do to eat? You'd have to eat. You couldn't go to the stores and buy food, could you? Yet there would be people out there that either have food stored or they're growing food. You might be able to go to a farmer and exchange something of value that you have. That's what you would have to do. Now, it doesn't matter if there is a bank, if there is money being held, or if there ever was money. You now have a solution that you can turn to. So why wouldn't you do that? Right? Are you still there, Leo?
Oh, yeah, I'm here. I just didn't quite follow the logic specifically because it's much more than farms. I mean, things have become so not just stratified, but just, shall we say, proliferated the areas of expertise. We're not just farmers and production workers anymore.
We're speaking hypothetically, okay? Imagine that the bank shut down tomorrow, okay? And you couldn't go to the bank and couldn't take out any money. And you have no groceries. And your next-door neighbor has a garden in their yard, okay? and they need some repairs done somewhere in their house, and you happen to have some wood and the skills to do the carpentry work. So you say, hey, I notice you've been complaining about this work that you need to get done in your house, and I'm capable of doing that, and I'm hungry. I've got to feed my family, and you've got some tomatoes and some peppers and some lettuce and some radishes in your garden. How about if we do an exchange, some food for some work? Okay, now you've solved your problem right there, and you didn't have to carry any currency with you. And this could be getting car repairs done, or mowing a lawn, or shoveling snow, teaching your kids. There's a million things that you could come up with, a million scenarios. The point
I'm
making...
And it's not taxable either.
Yeah, there are people out there that are farmers that are still growing food. You can say, well, they're paying the farmers not to grow food. No, the money's gone now. They're not paying anybody, right? The banks are closed. The money's not in circulation. How are you going to survive? You've got to look square at your own situation. You're not going to be concerned about your next-door neighbor or the guy across the street other than if you can do business with them on a barter system. So that may be your only opportunity. You're not going to be able to go steal. What are you going to steal? I mean, you're just going to create another problem for yourself by doing that. And no one is suggesting that anyone does that. That's the old way. That's part of the old system. They're stealing now. Okay? So you're going to create something. We are all going to create something different. That's what has to happen. That's what's happening, and that's definitely what's going to happen.
I'm looking forward to you tomorrow. I heard you first on Greg Everson's program, and I'm looking forward to you coming on with your big explosive info tomorrow.
Well, yeah, I appreciate that. For the listening audience out there, Leo is referring to the Voices from the Heartland show with Greg Evenson, and I and Dr. Qasem Khalil will be his special guests for 2 hours, starting, it's in the central time zone, noon, Eastern 1, and on the West Coast, 10 p.m., so a.m., 10 a.m. To noon. So if you want to tune in, that's what Leo's talking about. Leo, we could go on and on and on with this, but I think you kind of get the idea. If you take money off the table, which is an illusion. In fact, we're all equal at that point, are we not? If you take money off out of the equation, everybody on the planet is equal.
It makes sense, yeah. Well,
yeah.
Not really equal. We're without advantage. Because there is no real equality, but there's different levels of advantage.
Well, I don't know how one person would have an advantage over another unless they were totally incapable of doing anything. We all.
When I meant advantage, I meant economic advantage.
Well, there is no economy at that point. The economy is what you create. You yourself. Do you understand?
Oh yeah, obviously.
So you can't be in both places. It's one or the other. We're shutting down the economy. We're closing the banks. We're taking the money off the table as if it never existed. Now, what are you going to do? It's about doing. It's about being. It's not about having. You see? Or it's not about their game. It belongs to everybody. This earth belongs to everyone who's here, believe it or not. That's not how the game has been played. So these are things to consider, okay? I may be totally wrong in this. There may be a better solution than that. But right now, that's what our consciousness can conceive, and most people can kind of get an idea about doing that. People do that when they go camping. You know, somebody's got a lot of potatoes, and somebody else has meat, and they forgot to bring meat, and the other one forgot to bring the potatoes. And they say, hey, you know, if we split our food, we both have meat and potatoes to put on the grill. So people get along, they do the right thing. That's what we're talking about. Taking responsibility for ourselves and then becoming aware of what we can do.
So your
idea is right on target.
I'm thinking that what we really should be doing then is having some kind of orientation classes where we role play these things so that when the time comes and that we have to survive by those methodologies, we'll have sort of have a somewhat of an orientation, because I think most people won't be able to cope with these alternative realities that we're having forced on us.
Well, a starting point is this radio show, Leo. If you've been listening from the beginning, tell 10 of your friends or tell 100 of your friends to listen to this show. They'll learn some of that right there. I don't know who would give the orientation class. First of all, this is something that has probably was tried many times in the past, and people got suckered back into this illusory system, illusory fiat money, you know, money made out of thin air, and credit, which is even more ethereal. Okay, there's actually more substance to the swamp gas. Okay. Leo, thanks for calling in, and you know, glad to hear you're listening. And tell your friends about the show. Pay attention. We'll cover these aspects on future shows. You have my word on that.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'm looking forward to tomorrow.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Bye bye.
Well, there you
hey,
go,
Don?
Jim. Yes.
Yeah,
go ahead.
You know, that was an interesting exchange, and one thing that that Leo should. Feel gratified in is if it ever comes to the point where we go back to a barter system, ironically, the first people that will starve to death will be politicians, because they don't have anything to offer but hot air.
Well, they could help Al Gore write his new book on the leftover paper. Right. You know, the paper that they're not using.
Well, I understand, but what I'm saying is, seriously, you know, talk about filtering out the useless. I mean, in a situation like that, when there's a total economic collapse, if you don't have a talent or if you don't have something to barter, you're not going to make it.
Mm-hmm.
And those pudgy-fingered people with the fat behinds that are used to feeding at the pig trough are not going to have anything to barter for.
What an image you just created! I had to chuckle. You know, let's come back to what Leo was talking about. You see, he brought up some very good points, and I'm not saying he's incorrect. We could do show after show after show on this. He's expressing what we've been saying all along, haven't we? We've been saying we would hope people would awaken and realize what's going on. And Leo's awake, and Leo's thinking about these things. And he's obviously he's looking at it still from with inside the matrix. And as soon as you gain the insight, and he's at that point now where he's asking that question, so that insight is there. That awareness is coming to him, you see, and you know, folks, it's not that difficult to plant some seeds in the ground and allow nature to do its thing. That's how plants grow. That's how fruits and vegetables are produced. And that's how animals eat, is through the growth and the transition. It's a cycle. We see it every year. We see nature go through its own thing on its own without our help, without our interference. It does a great job. And so if we just pay attention to what nature does, it's really easy. You take, you know, you put a little hole in the ground. You loosen up the soil. You remove weeds and impediments that would suck away the nutrients from the soil. You clear an area. If you've got a yard full of grass, you clear an area and you turn it into dirt and you add some humus to it or some compost. Or some manure, and you rake it in real good, loosen the soil up. Then you make a few holes. You can take a pencil, using the eraser end of a pencil, and push it down a half an inch or an inch, depending on the type of seed. A seed pouch or a seed envelope actually tells you how deep to plant the seed. You drop the seed in the hole and you cover it with dirt. When you're done planting all the seeds, you water it a little bit. You keep the soil moist, allow it to get some sunlight, and before you know it, nature does its thing and you've got fruits and vegetables that you can eat. And it'll take you some practice doing it, but you can feed yourself with that. Now, there are people that have been doing this for thousands of years on this planet. It's not difficult to do it like a farmer does it, and plant acres and hundreds or thousands of acres of corn is a different technique. We're not talking about that. You don't eat that much food. But you can certainly feed yourself. That's going to be one of your most important criteria is for survival and having access to water, food and water. And let go of this concept that because you're not holding all the wealth of the world on a piece of paper, that you're not going to survive. Just the thought of that and the contemplation of that in silence is enough to lead you to the consciousness that's certainly a solution. Now, you might be a musician like myself, or you might be an artist, and you can create something for another person who's out there that has food that's willing to exchange. Or it might be a person that makes clothes or weaves fabric for making clothes. You might have a spouse or a relative or a friend that knows how to make clothes with a sewing machine or by hand. We don't know what the possibilities are. Maybe we'll never even come to a place where we have to go through that. Maybe something else will occur. But the thing is to be prepared and to realize that you've been controlled and this society has been controlled for at least the last 13,000 years and more likely the last 450,000 years. And that control has definitely stymied our growth as spiritual beings. We have a spirit and we have a means through which to tap into the ultimate accumulation throughout the universe of all the information that's out there. And if you're only using 3% of your mind, start using 4% and watch what happens, or 5%, and watch how creative you become. And pretty soon you'll be using 10% and 20%, and you'll be performing miracles compared to what's going on right now. Jim, any
and actually, Don, yeah, I do. Actually, what you're describing really is the way the world used to work before there were bankers.
Yeah, I guess so.
I mean, really, I mean, a farmer needs his horses shod, right? He goes to a blacksmith. The blacksmith measures the horses up, makes a bunch of shoes for them. Puts the horseshoes on the horse's feet, and the farmer pays him with a certain amount of vegetables and a side of beef. You know, it's that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, there was nothing wrong with that, except for the fact that you can't afford wealth. So it's a very equalizing and very trade-oriented arrangement. But it can work.
Yeah. See, we put and who knows? You know, people. We may move into a gold economy. You know, the Basel II Accord dictates that we here in the United States should be on a gold standard, and we're not, because they're busy hypothecating the funds, like you described, Jim, and I've described in my research, in my articles, and in many, many interviews or monologues on this show, talking about how they're stealing the country's wealth. And they're doing it by collateralizing the land we live on. You see, you're told when you buy a house and you're paying all these rates, these obscene mortgage rates to own your property, that it's yours. And yet you're being taxed on what you own. As if somehow, you know, the privilege of owning it requires you to pay a tax on it. And then on top of that, you come to a point where they can just come and take it away from you. They can make up any reason they want to take it away. So you're renting the property or you're leasing the property is what you're doing. You're a squatter that's paying for the privilege of squatting on the land. And they'll remove you when they good and well choose. That's the reality. That's why the real estate market is crashing, because they're taking every penny of every piece of property in this country and they're gambling with it as if they own it. Because in the sense they're backing this paper up with the fact that they'll go in there with an army and take it away if they have to. And they call that freedom. They call that democracy. And they go into other countries and do the same thing and then tell us that they're doing, and the rest of the world, that they're doing this to promote democracy, which is nothing but organized crime. Under the color of authority, under the color of the law, it's a two-sided coin. And every time they flip it, it comes up tails. They win. Heads, we lose.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you're right. It has been that way. And I'm sure before we had the banks, that's how people got along. Or that's how they survived, because I don't think people ever got along, you know.
Well, there are some things to be said for absolute barter systems. You know, if you're a cabinet maker, somebody may be able to steal one of your cabinets, but they can't steal your ability to make cabinets.
Yes.
And so the real wealth resides in the individual. And actually, that's where all wealth is anyway. Getting back to the whole subject of illusions, you know, even the currency is an illusion, whether it's backed by gold or not. Because the real wealth is in our creativity, in our determination, in our desire to labor, in our desire to accomplish something while we're alive. Those are the things that really constitute wealth. All this other nonsense, is just sauce on the duck.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about it is only by us believing in the system and subscribing to it do we actually give the power to the power mongers. They wouldn't have it if we didn't give it to them.
Yeah. Well, it's been, a couple years ago at least, when I first brought up the concept of if you took all the money off the table and there was no money, there were no banks, there were no bankers, there were no stockbrokers, all this illusion, smoke and mirrors, pull a rabbit out of the hat, finance system. What would be the difference between that former banker and myself or yourself or anybody? There would be no difference. In fact, we would probably be more powerful than those very people, because they would be most lost at getting along in a real world. So hopefully hopefully we gave Leo and the listening audience some inspiration. These are things we talked about on other shows. I know, just off the top of my head, you can go back and listen to the archives at BBS Radio or at my website, directlightproductions.com. Click on Evident Footprints on either website, and you can listen to January 6th. 2009, Michael St. Clair. And there are a couple of other interviews with Michael St. Clair where we talked about this very same issue. We're at a stage where we have to start taking responsibility for our individual and collective lives, not depending on someone else to do it for us. You have to do it yourself. And through the process of the awareness and insight that you gain from doing so, you will You will find yourself running into other people, meeting other people, opening opportunities for you to apply your skills, your gifts, in a meaningful and productive way. And that will produce a certain kind of abundance that will keep you alive and possibly even make you wealthy in its truest sense. Because wealth is, where there's no bank, abundance and wealth are still words that mean something. And they will take on a truer nature. They will actually become what they really are and not a fictitious, illusory picture of something else that gives someone else power. Well, did we cover everything on the El Dorado mines here? We went off on a tangent, but really, it's related in a way.
Well, no, we got to where I wanted to go. I wanted to conclude exactly where I did, that even though all this searching and what have you has been going on for the last 400 years, that ultimately you've got the same old gang involved. You got the Jesuits who are tied into the Black Pope and to the Catholic Church, and then, you know, you've got the gold in the hands of the bankers, and, you know, it's the same old story over and over again.
Yeah, and the bankers are the Zionists, are they not? I mean, they're known as Zionists. We've gone through that on other shows, but these people are all working in cahoots together through their secret societies, are they not?
Oh, Lord, there's many of them, many secret societies. And, you know, the goal of all these societies is apparently the same thing. You know, they all want to control the world. And to what end? That's beyond me. I know if the world was handed to me on a silver platter, I'd refuse it. I had enough headaches already.
Yeah. Okay, Jim. Well, we're out of time. It's been a great show, and I'm sure we'll have some more great topics to discuss in future shows. You're going to be our guest again next Friday, so I want to wish you a great weekend. Don't overwork yourself. I know how busy you are these days. Thank you for your information and your wonderful presentation and your willingness to discuss this outside the box. That's what we try to do here every night.
Well, it's my pleasure, Don. And as you know, I'll always be available as long as you want me. And hopefully we'll never run out of topics.
No. Not if things keep going like they are, we won't. And so I want to thank everybody who participated in tonight's show, Leo in Massachusetts, and again, our special guest, scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, teacher, Jim Murray. Special thanks to Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, Seth Hendrick on the sound, and most of all, you millions of people around the world listening in the listening audience. Thank you for tuning in. Have a wonderful weekend. Join us next week. We've got some great shows lined up for you the rest of the month and some new guests coming on board, new insights into who we are and what we can do to get back on track. In the meantime, you out there in the listening audience, have a night filled with peace, love, and light. Or a day. Some of you are listening during your daytime hours. I should acknowledge that. And have a good night.